Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This program is about why the law in the United States is sometimes called stupid, irrational, or perverse. Our guest is Leo Katz, a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. His book, Why the Law is So Perverse, presents multiple conundrums based on legal consequences that are sometimes unintended. Professor Katz and I visited by phone from his home in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on November 27, 2011, and began our conversation when I asked him to describe, using examples in his book, how the legal system in the United States evolved to create conundrums, contradictions, and unintended consequences.
For instance, the thing that most immediately strikes people as disturbing is the prevalence of loopholes and loophole exploitation. And it's often, for many people, being a lawyer is synonymous with being the kind of fellow who exploits loopholes. They're not necessarily immediately disturbed by that, because often, of course, when you go see a lawyer, it's because there's something you want to do that you can't do, or that's, you know, taxed too heavily, and you hope to see if the lawyer can find some way for you to accomplish it anyway. Of course, the other person looking upon what you're doing, finding a lawyer to plan some way around what seems like a legal prohibition, to him that looks like loophole exploitation, and he finds it very disturbing. Make that more concrete. One of my favorite simple illustrations is the fellow who visits this country on a visiting visa from a foreign country, and he'd really like to stay here. But all he has is a visiting visa, and he'd like to become an immigrant. What we think he ought to do is to, you know, return to his home country and try the same way that everybody else does who might want to become an immigrant, participate in an immigration lottery, or find some other grounds why we might want to let him into the United States, queue up with everyone else. But he's clever enough to seek out a lawyer and see if the lawyer maybe has some advice for him. And the lawyer asks him where he comes from, and he discovers that he comes from some, you know, third world country, some fairly tyrannical autocracy. And he says, well, there's, you know, sometimes people come here on political asylum. The fellow says, well, I know, but, you know, I'm actually not persecuted. I'm not on the outs with the government there. No one's ever threatened me with anything. And the lawyer asks him, and why is that? And he says, well, I've just never done anything to upset the government. You mean you've never spoken out against your tyrannical government? And the man says, no, I haven't really. If I had, I'd be in jail already. You would, says the lawyer. And of course, immediately light bulb goes on in the man's head, and he makes an announcement now, that some sort of public announcement that makes him persona non grata back home, and now he's able to ask for political asylum. And what he's found is a sort of loophole in our immigration law, utilizing the right of political asylum.
I think along with that loophole is a loophole of marriage without what people generally consider part of marriage.
Right. Now, there I distinguish between the more and the less disturbing loopholes of the law. That is a less disturbing one because, in a sense, we sort of immediately understand what's going on. It's, you know, obviously we want to grant immigration status, easy access to someone who genuinely gets married to someone who lives here, and we're not particularly interested in doing that to someone who just pretends to be married. And that loophole sort of arises because we've got a practical problem with distinguishing real from fake marriages. What I find so intriguing about this other kind of loophole is that it's not that there's anything fake about what he does. He really is, having made this announcement, he is persona non grata back home. If he went back home, he would be jailed. And so we can't just say, well, if we figured out some way to distinguish the real dissident from the fake dissident, then we wouldn't have a problem. Because even if we decide, you know, he just did this strategically in order to stay in this country, what are we going to do? Are we going to say, well, because you just did this to stay here, we're going to ship you back, never mind that you now might be executed or jailed? Or are we going to say, we'll let you be here, but we'll punish you because you contrive to stay in this country and to take advantage of our political asylum laws in a very strategic way? Because if we did that, we would essentially be enforcing, you know, the freedom of speech restrictions of that other country. Whenever somebody says something that offends that other country because it might be strategic so that he can stay here, we're going to jail him here. So we're in a profound dilemma about what to do about this loophole. It seems genuinely unclosable, and it's not a case of, you know, unlike the marriage loophole, it doesn't seem to arise, and it doesn't seem as though we could solve it by just being more observant and trying to figure out, are these people really married or are they just pretending? So that's one of the perversities of law, I think, that puzzles people, that they often think must be because our law is defective and maybe has a strange history. In fact, it's a universal. All legal regimes suffer from it. And the question arises, now why exactly is it so intractable? Shouldn't there be some way of dealing with it? There are several more of this general type that I deal with.
Maybe we could talk about the paradox on the issue of consent.
Yes, another aspect of the law that people find particularly disturbing is that there are many situations in which people think of arrangements or think of agreements that they would like to enter into that would be beneficial for them, that really only affect them and no one else, and somehow the law doesn't allow it. I mean, the things that most immediately come to mind, for instance, you know, surrogacy contracts in which one person would like to arrange with, you know, an infertile couple wants to arrange with another woman to bear their child. Might be biologically that woman's child, or might be biologically the child of the woman who wants to rent, as it were, the womb of another. Now, we allow that, but within limits. We even allow some compensation to be paid to the person who bears another person's child for her efforts, but it has to be limited to medical expenses and such things. We can't just have an ordinary contract in which I say, you know, I'll pay you $1 million if you do this for me. And in a way, it's kind of peculiar because, you know, it's between the two people, and if they think it's worth their while and it doesn't affect anyone else, and the woman who consents to it knows what she's doing, what's the problem?
So you're saying that the concept of public policy prohibits someone from paying that $1 million to another person who would bear their child?
Exactly. Now, the issue then is we say public policy, and that kind of sounds like it's a reason, but then you ask, you know, what's the public policy? Why should there be a public policy? Why is anyone else concerned? Why is the public concerned when this is just between the two? Now, don't get me wrong. This is, I sound here like a partisan for, you know, unlimited freedom of contract or for making this contract necessarily permissible or that there's anything wrong about the restrictions we impose on it. I pose it right now simply as a puzzle.
Well, I'm presuming that you're responding as a puzzle and a legal analyst having reviewed this in detail.
Yeah. When one thinks about surrogacy contracts, I think many people's reaction is, in fact, after reflecting on it, when they have trouble thinking of some reason why we might want to prohibit it, after they've overcome their gut aversion, they then might easily conclude, well, if I can't really think of a good reason, then probably it's okay, and maybe we're just making a mistake in going with our gut. So I want to give you an example of another kind of agreement that people might strike that also initially strikes us as bad, and where we have similar trouble thinking of a possible reason why it ought to be prohibited, but we don't afterwards conclude, therefore, it ought to be allowed. This weird contract I have in mind is a proposal that we could imagine someone making for changing our criminal justice system. And he's got this idea that, you know, prison is very expensive. The objective of prison is, after all, just to, you know, mostly to deter crime and to inflict retribution for wrongful actions. And we accomplish that by doing something painful to people, by putting them in jail for a long time. And then he points out, you know, doing something painful to people could be accomplished much more cheaply if we gave them the option that instead of serving a long sentence in jail, they could subject themselves to a very painful treatment for a much shorter period of time, what's conventionally called torture. So he proposes this ridiculous regime of voluntary torture, giving every prisoner the option of volunteering for a short period of intense pain in exchange for being released from prison. And he calibrates it so that for most prisoners, it's just, you know, barely preferable. So the result is then when they opt for this, you know, it's not that they get a big benefit, but it's enough of a benefit that they'll choose it. And as far as the public is concerned, we now get to inflict punishment on people. We get to achieve deterrence. We get to achieve retribution by inflicting torture on people. And they choose it voluntarily in the sense that if they want to, they can continue to serve their sentence. But if they don't want to, they can do this. Now, what's interesting is that this seems like sort of a win-win situation for everyone around, or at least it doesn't change things much for the prisoner. It greatly improves things for the public, it seems. we've achieved what we always wanted to achieve with the criminal justice system, and yet we don't do it.
It seems that there's a standard level of pain tolerance across society, whereas I think physiologically, some people have a much greater tolerance of pain than others.
That's sort of a practical problem. So it may be that, you know, if one actually wanted to operationalize this, maybe that would stand in the way, that it would be very hard to judge, you know, for some people, even what looks very painful to the outside isn't a big deal, so that in essence, when we give certain prisoners that option, we're essentially letting them go. It's almost like letting them go free. So if we were serious about this, we would run into these practical problems. My interest in this is mostly as a kind of thought experiment. Even if we didn't have this practical difficulty, even if we thought it would work, my guess is we would say, no way, absolutely not. Totally intolerable, even though it's kind of a win-win bargain. And it's for that reason that I find this example of a consensual arrangement that we want to prohibit more helpful than thinking about surrogacy contracts, because we recognize that it's win-win, but we strongly stick with our gut intuition despite that fact that it ought to be off limits. There's then the further mystery. Now, why do we continue to stick with that intuition that it should be off limits? But I think the intuition is probably a sound one that's worth respecting and makes one think that all sorts of things that we prohibit, that where we can't quite justify why we prohibit them, why we prohibit these contracts, nonetheless, there is probably some good reason that has so far eluded us.
How about prostitution?
Same kind of issue. That is, you know, one has this, of course, initially aversive reaction. Then you reflect on it, and you start to wonder, well, just because, after all, isn't it just between the prostitute's client and the prostitute? It's true there are sometimes certain external effects on the people who live in the neighborhood in which acts of prostitution take place. One also, of course, worries about the person who decides to enter into this and the prostitute herself how competent is she under all circumstances to make that decision and so on. But my hunch is that probably doesn't get to the essence of it, that our aversion to prostitute would survive elimination of all of these special circumstances. And now some people might then conclude, when we eliminate all these special circumstances, she's not competent to enter into this, and there's, you don't want red light districts and so on. They might then conclude, well, maybe then prostitution ought to be legal. And I'm not saying that, that's a ridiculous idea, because obviously lots of countries do it. But I would also suggest that our initial aversion to it probably deserves a fair bit of respect, just as it does in that torture context, where even if we have great trouble locating exactly why we think a regime of voluntary torture would be intolerable, we are willing to stick with that intuition, despite the fact that it seems like a win-win arrangement. In the book itself, I then try to explore reasons why, in fact, there's good sense behind that aversion. But before one even gets to that, it's worth noting that there's that aversion, the law reflects it, and the law is often quite wise in doing things that we can't necessarily fully explain and justify, but that probably reflect strongly felt judgments that on reflection may turn out to have a surprisingly solid basis.
This is Radio Curious, in conversation with law professor Leo Katz from the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of Why the Law is So Perverse. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Professor Leo Katz, let's talk again then about framing, which is what I think you were just doing on the issues of surrogacy and prostitution.
Framing is a subject that, and I think a label, that psychologists initially introduced in thinking about judgments of all sorts. They made a variety of observations about the way people make judgments, in particular judgments about risks, that turned out to be of enormous interest to lawyers, because they sort of captured a great deal of what lawyers do when they act as advocates and when they try to characterize facts in a particular way, favorable to their client. So you frame the same issue in one way, and people give one kind of response. Frame it another way, you give another kind of response. What a good lawyer does when he characterizes facts in favor of his client. And if he manages to characterize the choice in one way, well, then the choice that his client has made will be viewed as favorable. If he characterizes it in another way, it'll be viewed as unfavorable. There's the interesting question of ultimately how does this get decided, since the defense will try to characterize it one way and the prosecution will characterize it in another way.
So I think we may find out an answer to that in the upcoming presidential election based on the anticipated negative framing of Obama's tenure by the various Republican candidates.
For sure, right. I mean, it's in essence, on a larger scale, the familiar glass half empty, glass half full phenomenon, except that it's exploited, you know, with much greater skill and in much greater detail. Yep, that's the essence. That's the essence of the incumbent. He'll focus on the fact that he filled the glass half full, and they'll focus on the fact that he left it half empty. Right. Absolutely.
So let's shift a little bit here and talk about why the law takes an either-or position so much of the time, and the difficulty that many people have of living on a boundary line, whether the boundary line is real or imagined, perhaps characterized as some people have greater difficulty living with an ambiguity than others do.
Yeah, there's this moment in law school teaching where this problem particularly strikes students over the head, and they end up being very perplexed by it. There's an issue that arises in the law of property, sometimes called the eternal triangle of property law, and it's the following kind of situation. Somebody steals something, let's say a car, and then he sells this car to someone else who thinks that, you know, doesn't realize that it's stolen property. And then the thief disappears from the scene, and at some point the original owner finds the purchaser of the car in possession of his car, and he wants the car back. And now the law has a decision to make. Who gets the car? The original owner, or the innocent purchaser who paid good money for it, thinking that, didn't realize that it was a stolen car. Two innocent parties, and what the law generally does is, well, some legal regimes give the car back to the original owner. Some legal regimes let the car continue to remain in the possession of to remain with the innocent purchaser. But what's so disturbing is, well, we've got these two innocent parties. Why do we have to choose between them? You could kind of split the difference. Obviously, you can't cut the car in half, but you could say, well, one of them gets to have the car, and the other one maybe has to pay some money to the other one, and that way we'll divide the burden. What's so striking is that nowhere in the world, no legal regime, I've been told with one exception, Mongolian cattle law, is that option chosen. The law always sometimes chooses to prefer the original owner. Sometimes it chooses to prefer the innocent purchaser, but it's always one or the other, either one or the other. Mongolian cattle law, I gather, was if what's been stolen was cattle, they actually cut the beast in half and give half to each, the original owner and the innocent purchaser. And this is kind of emblematic, of course, what the law does with most things, most disputes. There's argument over what was there really a contract? Did these parties who negotiated over something come to enough of a closure that we're willing to say there's an agreement? And there's strong arguments to be made that there is, and strong arguments to be made that there isn't. And in class, we torture students with examples that are particularly hard to classify. But in the end, what the law does, it either decides there's a contract or there isn't a contract. And it does that with every legal doctrine. Is this a case of self-defense on the part of the defendant? And again, there's a set of arguments to be made on both sides, or the facts may be highly ambiguous, or even it's not just a matter that we can't find out what the facts are, but we can't figure out whether on these facts you want to say it was or was not self-defense. And again, in class, we mostly present students with these hard cases. They don't even get to court unless they're hard cases. But the law then eventually chooses it either is self-defense or it isn't. And you might think, well, if it's sort of in between, why do we have to say that it is one or the other? Why not say it's an in-between case? And because it's an in-between case, we'll say it's sort of self-defense, and we'll treat it, you know, we'll not punish it as severely as.
And that's where plea bargaining comes in.
In a way that makes the puzzle even weirder, because what happens in many of these in-between cases is that whether they're civil cases or criminal cases, is that the parties who have a hard time naturally anticipating what a court will do in such a close case will in the end compromise. So if the party that maintains it's a contract is asking for $100,000 in damages, and the other party that maintains it isn't and was hoping to get away without any liability but fears that there's a 50% chance they'll lose, they'll settle on $50,000 as the damages. And, you know, and if it's a criminal case, self-defense, there will be a plea bargain in which, you know, if the sentence would have been 5 years if a conviction had been obtained, and zero if there had been an acquittal, you know, then they might settle on a sentence that's, you know, half of 5 years. And maybe that sounds like not an unjust solution. The strange thing is we only get to that result in a settlement or in a plea bargain. If it actually goes to a judge, he doesn't have the option of saying it's sort of self-defense, therefore I'll give it 2.5 years, or it's sort of a contract but not quite a contract, and so I'll only give it $50,000. And so the mystery and the perversity of the law is, why do we only get these in-between solutions when parties choose to settle or to strike a plea bargain? Wouldn't it be more natural for the judge to acknowledge that, you know, most of reality is gray, most of reality is on a continuum, most of the time we're not in the clear category of it either is a contract or it isn't, we're in between. And so the just resolution is an in-between solution. But the law doesn't do that, and it's one of those universals across all legal regimes that, you know, is a mystery and cries out for an explanation.
Well, then my question is, what can we do about it? You as a law professor, I as an attorney in a small rural community in Northern California, have both been actively involved in the law for well over 40 years. In our respective roles, what is it that can be done about these perversities and these conundrums that you address in Why is the Law So Perverse, your book?
My book, is the very opposite of a call to reform. Some things that are strange about the law, the book tries to show, are really endemic to the very enterprise. When we've got law, we've got this kind of stuff. And for the most part, it really cannot be changed. It can be changed sometimes around the margins, but it's not an accident of history. It's universal because the very act of creating law logically usually entails many of these difficulties. It's the analogy that to me comes to mind is Garrison Keillor talking about the children of Lake Wobegon who are all above average. And it's a lament we often have. Why can't everybody be above average? And then, of course, we realize as a matter of logic, it's not possible. And it's the same thing I would say about many of the things, in particular the ones that I focus on in the book, that strike us as perverse about the law. They look like things that are annoying, that one would like to reform and change, but in fact, they're not really susceptible to reform. They are the kinds of things that just go with law, and for the most part, all one can do is resign oneself to them. If one happens to be an academic, maybe enjoy the study of them and the work and their ramifications, but it's probably futile to try to do anything to reform them, because in the end, you will discover if you reform them in one particular place, another version of it will simply pop up somewhere else.
In my experience dealing on a day-to-day basis with clients, my question repeatedly is, what is your goal? And usually the answer is, I want to get out of this mess as quickly and cheaply as possible. And that's where the opportunities are presented to compromise and hold your nose and go on with the rest of your life, or stay in the problem of 2009 or 2008 and drag it on out to 2012.
Fair enough. There's a great deal that the lawyer can do to solve the very practical problems that his clients come to him with. It's some of these larger problems about the law that unfortunately one just has to say, they're with us forever, we're stuck with them. They're the flip side of some things we like about the law, and as long as we have law and like to have law, we're stuck with those other things that are more annoying.
Well, Leo Katz, author of Why the Law is So Perverse, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about a eureka or an aha moment in your experience that has stuck with you or changed your life or modeled your life?
I'll give you a very small, not a very ambitious eureka or aha moment that happens to actually tie in with some of the work I do and indeed specifically with this book. It was a moment when I tried to sit down at a table at McDonald's. Looked for a table, and it was very crowded, and so I finally found a spot where somebody happened to be sitting, which usually makes one uneasy, except I realized he's not really sitting right exactly at the table I was sitting down, but he was sitting next to a table surface that was separated by a fraction of an inch from the table surface at which I was sitting down. I think you can picture what I'm thinking of. There are these tables that can be thought of as four people one table for four people, or two separate tables for, you know, two persons each, or one person at each. So by thinking about this as being two tables, suddenly I was completely disinhibited from sitting down at the one table. I didn't feel I was intruding on his privacy, although I was no further and no closer to him than I would have been if it had been one table. So I was struck by the fact that this little bit of formality in everyday life seemed to make such an enormous difference to how I behaved, and it drove home to me that formality is something that isn't peculiar to the law, that seems to be much more endemic, and yet it's such a salient feature of the law, and it makes one wonder whether maybe some of the roots of formality of the law are not at all what we think, but has to do with some of the more perverse aspects of everyday life and everyday morality. And that launched me on a line of inquiry closely connected to what became this book.
And tell us, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Well, I found thinking about the law infinitely fascinating, and that's precisely what I intend to do for hopefully quite a few more years to come. I have another book in the works called From Villainy to Felony that concerns itself with the problems and puzzles associated with all the various things that law criminalizes or turns into torts. It's books and articles like that I'm hoping will keep me busy and interested for a good long time to come.
And pending Villainy to Felony, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Yes, there's a wonderful book by a Dutch author named Harry Mulisch called The Assault, published, I think, in the early 1980s. It's actually turned into an Oscar-winning foreign movie, and it involves a fascinating incident that the author invented that happened at the end of the Second World War. It then follows the protagonist for the next 40 years. He is a child when this happens and witnesses this, and in each chapter of the book, he learns a slight additional detail about that incident, which dramatically shifts his perspective and his framing of what he encountered. And this continues to happen up until the last line of the book, when we see the final frame and the final verdict and our final judgment about what really happened. It's not a book specifically about law, and yet everything that goes into thinking about law is beautifully illustrated. It's a short novel, about 150, 170 pages, utterly absorbing, a sort of moral thriller.
Well, Leo Katz, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry. It's a great pleasure.
Leo Katz is a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The book that he recommends is The Assault by Harry Mulisch. All editions of Radio Curious are free for anyone, anywhere, to listen, download, and enjoy. There are about 400 archive editions on our website, www.radiocurious.org. You may subscribe to our podcast at our website. Our email is curious@radiocurious.org. Snail mail is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. Christina Onestad is the associate producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.